The beginning of health lies in knowing the disease and in the sick man's willingness to take the medicines which the physician prescribes. You are sick. You know what ails you, and heaven, or more properly speaking, God, who is our physician, will administer medicines that will cure you, and cure gradually, and not of a sudden or by a miracle. Besides, sinners of discernment are nearer amendment than those who are fools. And as your worship has shown good sense in your remarks, all you have to do is to keep up a good heart, and trust that the weakness of your conscience will be strengthened. And if you have any desire to shorten the journey and put yourself easily in the way of salvation, come with me, and I will show you how to become a knight-errant, a calling wherein so many hardships and mishaps are encountered that if they be taken as penances, they will lodge you in heaven in a trice. Roque laughed at Don Quixote's exhortation, and changing the conversation he related the tragic affair of Claudia Jeronima, at which Sancho was extremely grieved, for he had not found the young woman's beauty, boldness, and spirit at all amiss. And now the squires dispatched to make the prize came up, bringing with them two gentlemen on horseback, two pilgrims on foot, and a coach full of women with some six servants on foot and on horseback in attendance on them, and a couple of muleteers whom the gentlemen had with them. The squires made a ring round them, both victors and vanquished maintaining profound silence, waiting for the great Roque Guinart to speak. He asked the gentlemen who they were, whither they were going, and what money they carried with them.
"Señor," replied one of them, "we are two captains of Spanish infantry. Our companies are at Naples, and we are on our way to embark in four galleys which they say are at Barcelona under orders for Sicily. And we have about 200 or 300 crowns, with which we are, according to our notions, rich and contented, for a soldier's poverty does not allow a more extensive hoard."
Roque asked the pilgrims the same question he had put to the captains, and was answered that they were going to take ship for Rome, and that between them they might have about 60 reals. He asked also who was in the coach, whither they were bound, and what money they had, and one of the men on horseback replied,
"The persons in the coach are my lady Doña Guillermina de Quiñones, wife of the regent of the Vicaria at Naples, her little daughter, a handmaid, and a duenna. We six servants are in attendance upon her, and the money amounts to 600 crowns.
"So then," said Roque Guinart, "we have got here 900 crowns and 60 reals. My soldiers must number some 60. See how much there falls to each, for I am a bad arithmetician."
As soon as the robbers heard this, they raised a shout of, "Long live Roque Guinart, in spite of the curs that seek his ruin!" The captains showed plainly the concern they felt. The regent's lady was downcast, and the pilgrims did not at all enjoy seeing their property confiscated. Roque kept them in suspense in this way for a while, but he had no desire to prolong their distress, which might be seen a bowshot off, and turning to the captains he said,
"Sirs, will your worships be pleased of your courtesy to lend me 60 crowns, and her ladyship the regent's wife 80, to satisfy this band that follows me? For it is by his singing the abbot gets his dinner, and then you may at once proceed on your journey free and unhindered, with a safe conduct which I shall give you, so that if you come across any other bands of mine that I have scattered in these parts, they may do you no harm. For I have no intention of doing injury to soldiers or to any woman, especially one of quality."
Profuse and hearty were the expressions of gratitude with which the captains thanked Roque for his courtesy and generosity, for such they regarded his leaving them their own money. Señora Doña Guillermina de Quiñones wanted to throw herself out of the coach to kiss the feet and hands of the great Roque, but he would not suffer it on any account. So far from that, he begged her pardon from the wrong he had done her under pressure of the inexorable necessities of his unfortunate calling. The regent's lady ordered one of her servants to give the 80 crowns that had been assessed as her share at once, for the captains had already paid down their 60. The pilgrims were about to give up the whole of their little hoard, but Roque bade them keep quiet, and turning to his men he said,
"Of these crowns 2 fall to each man, and 20 remain over. Let 10 be given to these pilgrims, and the other 10 to this worthy squire, that he may be able to speak favourably of this adventure."
And then, having writing materials, with which he always went provided, brought to him, he gave them in writing a safe conduct to the leaders of his bands, and bidding them farewell, let them go free, and filled with admiration at his magnanimity, his generous disposition, and his unusual conduct, and inclined to regard him as an Alexander the Great,
rather than a notorious robber. One of the squires observed in his mixture of Gascon and Catalan,
"This captain of ours would make a better friar than highwayman. If he wants to be so generous another time, let it be with his own property and not ours."
The unlucky wight did not speak so low but that Roque overheard him, and drawing his sword almost split his head in two, saying, "That is the way I punish impudent saucy fellows." They were all taken aback, and not one of them dared to utter a word, such deference did they pay him. Roque then withdrew to one side and wrote a letter to a friend of his at Barcelona, telling him that the famous Don Quixote of La Mancha, the knight-errant of whom there was so much talk, was with him, and was, he assured him, the drollest and wisest man in the world, and that in 4 days from that date, that is to say, on St. John the Baptist's day, he was going to deposit him in full armour, mounted on his horse Rocinante, together with his squire Sancho on an ass, in the middle of the strand of the city, and bidding him give notice of this to his friends, the Niaros, that they might divert themselves with him. He wished, he said, his enemies the Cadels could be deprived of this pleasure, but that was impossible, because the crazies and shrewd sayings of Don Quixote and the humours of his squire Sancho Panza could not help giving general pleasure to all the world. He dispatched the letter by one of his squires, who, exchanging the costume of a highwayman for that of a peasant, made his way into Barcelona, and gave it to the person to whom it was directed. Chapter 61 Of what happened to Don Quixote on entering Barcelona, together with other matters that partake of the true rather than of the ingenious. Don Quixote passed 3 days and 3 nights with Roque, and had he passed 300 years he would have found enough to observe and wonder at in his mode of life. At daybreak they were in one spot, at dinner-time in another. Sometimes they fled without knowing from whom, at other times they lay in wait not knowing for what. They slept standing, breaking their slumbers to shift from place to place. There was nothing but sending out spies and scouts, posting sentinels and blowing the matches of arquebuses, though they carried but few, for almost all used flintlocks. Roque passed his nights in some place or other apart from his men, that they might not know where he was, for the many proclamations the Viceroy of Barcelona had issued against his life kept him in fear and uneasiness, and he did not venture to trust anyone, afraid that even his own men would kill him or deliver him up to the authorities. Of a truth, a weary, miserable life. At length, by unfrequented roads, short cuts, and secret paths, Roque, Don Quixote, and Sancho, together with 6 squires, set out for Barcelona. They reached the strand on St. John's Eve during the night, and Roque, after embracing Don Quixote and Sancho, to whom he presented the 10 crowns he had promised but had not until then given, left them with many expressions of goodwill on both sides. Roque went back, while Don Quixote remained on horseback, just as he was, waiting for day. And it was not long before the countenance of the fair Aurora began to show itself at the balconies of the east, gladdening the grass and flowers, if not the ear. Though to gladden that, too, there came at the same moment a sound of clarions and drums, and a din of bells, and a tramp, tramp, and cries of "Clear the way there!" of some runners that seemed to issue from the city. The dawn made way for the sun that, with a face broader than a shield, began to rise slowly above the low line of the horizon. Don Quixote and Sancho gazed all round them. They beheld the sea, a sight until then unseen by them. It struck them as exceedingly spacious and broad, much more so than the lakes of Ruidera, which they had seen in La Mancha. They saw the galleys along the beach, which, lowering their awnings, displayed themselves decked with streamers and pennons that trembled in the breeze, and kissed and swept the water, while on board the bugles, trumpets, and clarions were sounding and filling the air far and near with melodious, warlike notes. Then they began to move and execute a kind of skirmish upon the calm water, while a vast number of horsemen on fine horses and in showy liveries, issuing from the city, engaged on their side in a somewhat similar movement. The soldiers on board the galleys kept up a ceaseless fire, which they on the walls and forts of the city returned, and the heavy cannon rent the air with the tremendous noise they made, to which the gangway guns of the galleys replied. The bright sea, the smiling earth, the clear air, though at times darkened by the smoke of the guns, all seemed to fill the whole multitude with unexpected delight. Sancho could not make out how it was that those great masses that moved over the sea, had so many feet. And now the horsemen in livery came galloping up with shouts and outlandish cries and cheers to where Don Quixote stood amazed and wondering. And one of them, he to whom Roque had sent word, addressing him, exclaimed,
"Welcome to our city, mirror, beacon, star, and cynosure of all knight-errantry in its widest extent. Welcome, I say, valiant Don Quixote of La Mancha, not the false, the fictitious, the apocryphal that these latter days have offered us in lying histories, but the true, the legitimate, the real one that Cide Hamete Benengeli, flower of historians, has described to us."
Don Quixote made no answer, nor did the horsemen wait for one, but wheeling again with all their followers, they began curveting around Don Quixote, who, turning to Sancho, said,
"These gentlemen have plainly recognized us. I will wager they have read our history, and even that newly printed one by the Aragonese."
The cavalier who had addressed Don Quixote again approached him and said,
"Come with us, Señor Don Quixote, for we are all of us your servants and great friends of Roque Guinart's."
To which Don Quixote returned,
"If courtesy breeds courtesy, yours, Sir Knight, is daughter or very nearly akin to the great Roque's. Carry me where you please. I will have no will but yours, especially if you deign to employ it in your service."
The cavalier replied with words no less polite, and then, all closing in around him, they set out with him for the city to the music of the clarions and the drums. As they were entering it, the Wicked One, who is the author of all mischief, and the boys, who are wickeder than the Wicked One, contrived that a couple of these audacious, irrepressible urchins should force their way through the crowd, and lifting up one of them Dapple's tail and the other Rocinante's, insert a bunch of gorse under each. The poor beasts felt the strange spurs and added to their anguish by pressing their tails tight, so much so that, cutting a multitude of capers, they flung their masters to the ground. Don Quixote, covered with shame and out of countenance, ran to pluck the plume from his poor jade's tail, while Sancho did the same for Dapple. His conductors tried to punish the audacity of the boys, but there was no possibility of doing so, for they hid themselves among the hundreds of others that were following them. Don Quixote and Sancho mounted once more, and with the same music and acclamations reached their conductor's house, which was large and stately, that of a rich gentleman, in short. And there, for the present, we will leave them, for such is Cide Hamete's pleasure. Chapter 62, which deals with the adventure of the Enchanted Head, together with other trivial matters that cannot be left untold. Don Quixote's host was one Don Antonio Moreno by name, a gentleman of wealth and intelligence, and very fond of diverting himself in any fair and good-natured way. And having Don Quixote in his house, he set about devising modes of making him exhibit his mad points in some harmless fashion. For jests that give pain are no jests, and no sport is worth anything if it hurts another. The first thing he did was to make Don Quixote take off his armour, and lead him, in that tight chamois suit we have already described and depicted more than once, out on a balcony overhanging one of the chief streets of the city, in full view of the crowd and of the boys, who gazed at him as they would at a monkey. The cavaliers in livery careered before him again, as though it were for him alone and not to enliven the festival of the day that they wore it, and Sancho was in high delight, for it seemed to him that, how he knew not, he had fallen upon another Camacho's wedding, another house like Don Diego de Miranda's, another castle like the Duke's. Some of Don Antonio's friends dined with him that day, and all showed honour to Don Quixote, and treated him as a knight-errant, and he, becoming puffed up and exalted in consequence, could not contain himself for satisfaction. Such were the drolleries of Sancho that all the servants of the house and all who heard him were kept hanging upon his lips. While at table, Don Antonio said to him,
"We hear, worthy Sancho, that you are so fond of capons and sausages that if you have any left you keep them in your pockets for the next day."
"No, Señor, that's not true," said Sancho, "for I am more cleanly than greedy, and my master Don Quixote here knows well that we too are used to live for a week on a handful of acorns or nuts. To be sure, if it so happens that they offer me a heifer, I run with a halter. I mean, I eat what I'm given and make use of opportunities as I find them. But whoever says that I'm an out-of-the-way eater or not cleanly, let me tell him that he is wrong, and I'd put it in a different way if I did not respect the honourable beards that are at the table."
"Indeed," said Don Quixote,
Sancho's moderation and cleanliness in eating might be inscribed and engraved on plates of brass to be kept in eternal remembrance in ages to come. It is true that when he is hungry there is a certain appearance of voracity about him, for he eats at a great pace and chews with both jaws at once. But cleanliness he is always mindful of, and when he was governor he learned how to eat daintily, so much so that he eats grapes and even pomegranate pips with a fork.
What? Said Don Antonio. Has Sancho been a governor?
Aye, said Sancho, and of an island called Barataria. I governed it to perfection for 10 days, and lost my rest all the time, and learned to look down upon all the governments in the world. I got out of it by taking to flight, and fell into a pit where I gave myself up for dead, and out of which I escaped alive by a miracle.
Don Quixote then gave them a minute account of the whole affair of Sancho's government, with which he greatly amused his hearers. On the cloth being removed, Don Antonio, taking Don Quixote by the hand, passed with him into a distant room, in which there was nothing in the way of furniture except a table, apparently of jasper, resting on a pedestal of the same, upon which was set up, after the fashion of the busts of the Roman emperors, a head which seems to be of bronze. Don Antonio traversed the whole apartment with Don Quixote, and walked round the table several times, and then said,
"Now, Señor Don Quixote, that I am satisfied that no one is listening to us, and that the door is shut, I will tell you one of the rarest adventures, or more properly speaking, strange things, that can be imagined, on condition that you will keep what I say to you in the remotest recesses of secrecy."
"I swear it," said Don Quixote, "and for greater security I will put a flagstone over it. For I would have you know, Señor Don Antonio,"
he had by this time learnt his name,
"that you are addressing one who, though he has ears to hear, has no tongue to speak, so that you may safely transfer whatever you have in your bosom into mine, and rely upon it that you have consigned it to the depths of silence."
"In reliance upon that promise," said Don Antonio, "I will astonish you with what you shall see and hear, and relieve myself of some of the vexation it gives me to have no one to whom I can confide my secrets, for they are not of a sort to be entrusted to everybody."
Don Quixote was puzzled, wondering what could be the object of such precautions. Whereupon Don Antonio, taking his hand, passed it over the bronze head, and the whole table and the pedestal of jasper on which it stood, and then said,
"This head, Señor Don Quixote, has been made and fabricated by one of the greatest magicians and wizards the world ever saw, a Pole, I believe, by birth, and a pupil of the famous Escotillo, of whom such marvellous stories are told. He was here in my house, and for a consideration of 1,000 crowns that I gave him, he constructed this head, which has the property and virtue of answering whatever questions are put to its ear. He observed the points of the compass, he traced figures, he studied the stars, he watched favourable moments, and at length brought it to the perfection we shall see tomorrow. For on Fridays it is mute, and this being Friday we must wait till the next day. In the interval your worship may consider what you would like to ask it, and I know by experience that in all its answers it tells the truth."
Don Quixote was amazed at the virtue and property of the head, and was inclined to disbelieve Don Antonio. But seeing what a short time he had to wait to test the matter, he did not choose to say anything except that he thanked him for having revealed to him so mighty a secret. They then quitted the room, Don Antonio locked the door, and they repaired to the chamber where the rest of the gentlemen were assembled. In the meantime, Sancho had recounted to them several of the adventures and accidents that had happened his master. That afternoon they took Don Quixote out for a stroll, not in his armour, but in street costume, with a surcoat of tawny cloth upon him, that at that season would have made ice itself sweat. Orders were left with the servants to entertain Sancho so as not to let him leave the house. Don Quixote was mounted not on Rocinante, but upon a tall mule of easy pace and handsomely caparisoned. They put the surcoat on him, and on the back, without his perceiving it, they stitched a parchment on which they wrote in large letters, "This is Don Quixote of La Mancha." As they set out upon their excursion, the placard attracted the eyes of all who chanced to see him, and as they read out, "This is Don Quixote of La Mancha," Don Quixote was amazed to see how many people gazed at him, called him by his name, and recognized him. And turning to Don Antonio, who rode at his side, he observed to him,
"Great are the privileges knight-errantry involves, for it makes him who professes it known and famous in every region of the earth. See, Don Antonio, Even the very boys of this city know me without ever having seen me. True, Señor Don Quixote, returned Don Antonio, for as fire cannot be hidden or kept secret, virtue cannot escape being recognized, and that which is attained by the profession of arms shines distinguished above all others.
It came to pass, however, that as Don Quixote was proceeding amid the acclamations that have been described, a Castilian, reading the inscription on his back, cried out in a loud voice,
"The devil take thee for a Don Quixote of La Mancha! What, art thou here and not dead of the countless drubbings that have fallen on thy ribs? Thou art mad, and if thou wert so by thyself and kept thyself within thy madness, it would not be so bad. But thou hast the gift of making fools and blockheads of all who have anything to do with thee or say to thee. Why, look at these gentlemen bearing thee company. Get thee home, blockhead, and see after thy affairs and thy wife and children, and give over these fooleries that are sapping thy brains and skimming away thy wits."
"Go your own way, brother," said Don Antonio, "and don't offer advice to those who don't ask you for it. Señor Don Quixote is in his full senses, and we who bear him company are not fools. Virtue is to be honoured wherever it may be found. Go, and bad luck to you, and don't meddle where you are not wanted."
"By God, your worship is right," replied the Castilian, "for to advise this good man is to kick against the pricks. Still, for all that, it fills me with pity that the sound wit they say the blockhead has in everything should dribble away by the channel of his knight-errantry. But may the bad luck your worship talks of follow me and all my descendants, if, from this day forth, though I should live longer than Methuselah, I ever give advice to anybody, even if he asks me for it."
The advice-giver took himself off, and they continued their stroll. But so great was the press of the boys and people to read the placard, that Don Antonio was forced to remove it as if he were taking off something else. Night came, and they went home. And there was a ladies' dancing party, for Don Antonio's wife, a lady of rank and gaiety, beauty and wit, had invited some friends of hers to come and do honour to her guest and amuse themselves with his strange delusions. Several of them came. They supped sumptuously. The dance began at about 10 o'clock. Among the ladies were two of a mischievous and frolicsome turn, and though perfectly modest, somewhat free in playing tricks for harmless diversion's sake. These two were so indefatigable in taking Don Quixote out to dance that they tired him down not only in body but in spirit. It was a sight to see the figure Don Quixote made, long, lank, lean, and yellow, his garments clinging tight to him, ungainly, and above all anything but agile. The gay ladies made secret love to him, and he, on his part, secretly repelled them, but finding himself hard-pressed by their blandishments, he lifted up his voice and exclaimed,
"Fugite partes, adversae! Leave me in peace, unwelcome overtures, avaunt! With your desires, ladies, for she who is queen of mine, the peerless Dulcinea del Toboso, suffers none but hers to lead me captive and subdue me."
And so saying, he sat down on the floor in the middle of the room, tired out and broken down by all this exertion in the dance. Don Antonio directed him to be taken up bodily and carried to bed, and the first that laid hold of him was Sancho, saying as he did so,
"In an evil hour you took to dancing, master mine? Do you fancy all men of valour are dancers, and all knights-errant given to capering? If you do, I can tell you you are mistaken. There's many a man would rather undertake to kill a giant than cut a caper. If it had been the shoe-jig you were at, I could take your place, for I can frisk away like a gerfalcon. But I'm no good at dancing."
With these and other observations, Sancho set the whole ballroom laughing, and then put his master to bed, covering him up well so that he might sweat out any chill caught after his dancing. The next day, Don Antonio thought he might as well make trial of the enchanted head, and with Don Quixote, Sancho, and two others, friends of his, besides the two ladies that had tired out Don Quixote at the ball, who had remained for the night with Don Antonio's wife, he locked himself up in the chamber where the head was. He explained to them the property it possessed and entrusted the secret to them, telling them that now for the first time he was going to try the virtue of the enchanted head. But except Don Antonio's two friends, no one else was privy to the mystery of the enchantment, and if Don Antonio had not first revealed it to them, they would have been inevitably reduced to the same state of amazement as the rest, so artfully and skilfully was it contrived. The first to approach the ear of the head was Don Antonio himself, and in a low voice, but not so low as not to be audible to all, he said to it,
"Head, tell me by the virtue that lies in thee, what am I at this moment thinking of?"
The head, without any movement of the lips,
answered in a clear and distinct voice so as to be heard by all, "I cannot judge of thoughts." All were thunderstruck at this, and all the more so as they saw that there was nobody anywhere near the table or in the whole room that could have answered.
"How many of us are here?"
asked Don Antonio once more. And it was answered him in the same way, softly,
"Thou and thy wife, with two friends of thine and two of hers, and a famous knight called Don Quixote of La Mancha, and a squire of his, Sancho Panza by name."
Now there was fresh astonishment. Now everyone's hair was standing on end with awe, and Don Antonio, retiring from ahead, exclaimed,
"This suffices to show me that I have not been deceived by him who sold thee to me, O sage head, talking head, answering head, wonderful head! And let someone else go and put what question he likes to it."
And as women are commonly impulsive and inquisitive, the first to come forward was one of the two friends of Don Antonio's wife, and her question was,
"Tell me, head, what shall I do to be very beautiful?"
And the answer she got was, "Be very modest."
"I question thee no further," said the fair querist.
Her companion then came up and said,
"I should like to know, head, whether my husband loves me or not."
The answer given to her was, "Think how he uses thee, and thou mayest guess." And the married lady went off saying,
"That answer did not need a question, for of course the treatment one receives shows the disposition of him from whom it is received."
Then one of Don Antonio's two friends advanced and asked it,
"Who am I?"
"Thou knowest," was the answer.
"That is not what I ask thee," said the gentleman, "but to tell me if thou knowest me."
"Yes, I know thee. Thou art Don Pedro Noriz," was the reply.
"I do not seek to know more," said the gentleman, "for this is enough to convince me, O head, that thou knowest everything."
And as he retired, the other friend came forward and asked it,
"Tell me, head, what are the wishes of my eldest son?"
"I have said already," was the answer, "that I cannot judge of wishes. However, I can tell thee, the wish of thy son is to bury thee."
"That's as much as what I see with my eyes I point out with my finger," said the gentleman. "So I ask no more."
Don Antonio's wife came up and said, "I know not what to ask thee, head. I would only seek to know of thee if I shall have many years of enjoyment of my good husband."
And the answer she received was, "Thou shalt, for his vigour and his temperate habits promise many years of life, which by their intemperance others so often cut short." Then Don Quixote came forward and said,
"Tell me, thou that answerest, was that which I describe as having happened to me in the cave of Montesinos the truth or a dream? Will Sancho's whipping be accomplished without fail? Will the disenchantment of Dulcinea be brought about?"
"As to the question of the cave," was the reply, "there is much to be said. There is something of both in it. Sancho's whipping will proceed leisurely. The disenchantment of Dulcinea will attain its due consummation."
"I seek to know no more," said Don Quixote. "Let me but see Dulcinea disenchanted, and I will consider that all the good fortune I could wish for has come upon me all at once."
The last questioner was Sancho, and his questions were,
"Head, shall I by any chance have another government? Shall I ever escape from the hard life of a squire? Shall I get back to see my wife and children?"
To which the answer came,
"Thou shalt govern in thy house. And if thou returnest to it, thou shalt see thy wife and children. And on ceasing to serve, thou shalt cease to be a squire."
"Good, by God," said Sancho Panza. "I could have told myself that. It's as much good as a prophecy from Perogrullo." "What answer wouldst thou have, beast?" said Don Quixote. "Is it not enough that the replies this head has given suits the questions put to it?"
"Yes, it is enough," said Sancho. "But I should have liked it to have made itself plainer and told me more."
The questions and answers came to an end here, but not the wonder with which all were filled, except Don Antonio's two friends, who were in the secret. This Cide Hamete Benengeli thought fit to reveal at once, not to keep the world in suspense, fancying that the head had some strange magical mystery in it.
He says, therefore, that on the model of another head, the work of an image-maker, which he had seen at Madrid, Don Antonio made this one at home for his own amusement and to astonish ignorant people. And its mechanism was as follows. The table was of wood, painted and varnished to imitate jasper, and the pedestal on which it stood was of the same material, with four eagle's claws projecting from it to support the weight more steadily. The head, which resembled a bust or figure of a Roman emperor, and was coloured like bronze, was hollow throughout, as was the table, into which it was fitted so exactly that no trace of the joining was visible. The pedestal of the table was also hollow, and communicated with the throat and neck of the head, and the whole was in communication with another room underneath the chamber in which the head stood. Throughout the entire cavity in the pedestal, table, throat, and neck of the bust or figure, there passed a tube of tin carefully adjusted and concealed from sight. In the room below, corresponding to the one above, was placed the person who was to answer, with his mouth to the tube, and the voice, as in an ear trumpet, passed from above downwards and from below upwards, the words coming clearly and distinctly. It was impossible, thus, to detect the trick. A nephew of Don Antonio's, a smart, sharp-witted student, was the answerer, and as he had been told beforehand by his uncle who the persons were that would come with him that day into the chamber where the head was, it was an easy matter for him to answer the first question at once and correctly. The others he answered by guesswork and, being clever, cleverly. Sidi Hamete adds that this marvellous contrivance stood for some 10 or 12 days, but that, as it became noised abroad through the city that he had in his house an enchanted head that answered all who asked questions of it, Don Antonio, fearing it might come to the ears of the watchful sentinels of our faith, explained the matter to the inquisitors, who commanded him to break it up and have done with it, lest the ignorant vulgar should be scandalized. By Don Quixote, however, and by Sancho, the head was still held to be an enchanted one, and capable of answering questions, though more to Don Quixote's satisfaction than Sancho's. The gentlemen of the city, to gratify Don Antonio, and also to do the honours to Don Quixote, and give him an opportunity of displaying his folly, made arrangements for a tilting at the ring in 6 days from that time, which, however, for reasons that will be mentioned hereafter, did not take place. Don Quixote took a fancy to stroll about the city quietly and on foot, for he feared that if he went on horseback the boys would follow him. So he and Sancho and two servants that Don Antonio gave him set out for a walk. Thus it came to pass that going along one of the streets, Don Quixote lifted up his eyes and saw written in very large letters over a door, "Books printed here," at which he was vastly pleased, for until then he had never seen a printing office, and he was curious to know what it was like. He entered with all his following, and saw them drawing off the sheets in one place, correcting in another, setting up type here, revising there, in short, all the work that is to be seen in great printing offices. He went up to one case and asked what they were about there. The workman told him. He watched them with wonder and passed on. He approached one man, among others, and asked him what he was doing. The workman replied, "Signor, this gentleman here," pointing to a man of prepossessing appearance and a certain gravity of look, "has translated an Italian book into our Spanish tongue, and I am setting it up in type for the press." "What is the title of the book?" asked Don Quixote, to which the author replied, "Signor, in Italian, the book is called Le Bagatelle." "And what does Le Bagatelle import in our Spanish?" asked Don Quixote. "The Bagatelle," said the author, "is, as though we should say in Spanish, trivialities. But though the book is humble in name, it has good, solid matter in it." "I," said Don Quixote, "have some little smattering of Italian, and I plume myself on singing some of Ariosto's stanzas. But tell me, signor, I do not say this to test your ability, but merely out of curiosity, have you ever met with the word pignata in your book?"
"Yes, often," said the author.
"And how do you render that in Spanish?"
"How should I render it," returned the author, "but by stewpot?"
"Body o' me," exclaimed Don Quixote,
"what a proficient you are in the Italian language!
I would lay a good wager that where they say in Italian piace, you say please. Where they say pew, you say more, and you translate su by above and due by beneath."
"I translate them so, of course," said the author, "for those are their proper equivalents."
"I would venture to swear," said Don Quixote, that your worship is not known in the world, which always begrudges their reward to rare wits and praiseworthy labours. What talents lie wasted there! What genius thrust away into corners! What worth left neglected! Still, it seems to me that translation from one language into another, if it be not from the queens of languages, the Greek and the Latin, is like looking at Flemish tapestries on the wrong side. For though the figures are visible, they are full of threads that make them indistinct, and they do not show with the smoothness and brightness of the right side. And translation from easy languages argues neither ingenuity nor command of words, any more than transcribing or copying out one document from another. But I do not mean by this to draw the inference that no credit is to be allowed for the work of translating, for a man may employ himself in ways worse and less profitable to himself. This estimate does not include two famous translators, Dr. Cristobal de Figueroa in his Pastor Fido, and Don Juan de Jaregui in his Aminta, wherein, by their felicity, they leave in doubt which is the translation and which the original. But tell me, are you printing this book at your own risk, or have you sold the copyright to some bookseller?
I print at my own risk, said the author, and I expect to make 1,000 ducats at least by this first edition, which is to be of 2,000 copies that will go off in a twinkling at 6 reals apiece.
A fine calculation you are making, said Don Quixote. It is plain you don't know the ins and outs of the printers, and how they play into one another's hands. I promise you, when you find yourself saddled with 2,000 copies, you will feel so sore that it will astonish you, particularly if the book is a little out of the common and not in any way highly spiced.
What? Said the author. Would your worship then have me give it to a bookseller who will give 3 maravedis for the copyright and think he is doing me a favour? I do not print my books to win fame in the world, for I am known in it already by my works. I want to make money, without which reputation is not worth a rap.
God send your worship good luck, said Don Quixote. And he moved on to another case, where he saw them correcting a sheet of a book with the title of Light of the Soul. Noticing it, he observed,
Books like this, though there are many of the kind, are the ones that deserve to be printed. For many are the sinners in these days, and lights unnumbered are needed for all that are in darkness.
He passed on, and saw they were also correcting another book, and when he asked its title, they told him it was called The Second Part of the Ingenious Gentleman Don Quixote of La Mancha, by one of Tordesillas.
I have heard of this book already, said Don Quixote, and verily and on my conscience I thought it had been by this time burned to ashes as a meddlesome intruder. But its Martinmas will come to it, as it does to every pig. For fictions have more merit and charm about them the more nearly they approach the truth, or what looks like it, and true stories, the truer they are, the better they are.
And so saying, he walked out of the printing office with a certain amount of displeasure in his looks. That same day Don Antonio arranged to take him to see the galleys that lay at the beach, whereat Sancho was in high delight, as he had never seen any all his life. Don Antonio sent word to the commandant of the galleys that he intended to bring his guest, the famous Don Quixote of La Mancha, of whom the commandant and all the citizens had already heard, that afternoon to see them. And what happened on board of them will be told in the next chapter. Chapter 63 Of the mishap that befell Sancho Panza through the visit to the galleys, and the strange adventure of the fair Morisco. Profound were Don Quixote's reflections on the reply of the enchanted head, not one of them, however, hitting on the secret of the trick, but all concentrated on the promise, which he regarded as a certainty, of Dulcinea's disenchantment. This he turned over in his mind again and again with great satisfaction, fully persuaded that he would shortly see its fulfilment. And as for Sancho, though, as has been said, he hated being a governor, still he had a longing to be giving orders and finding himself obeyed once more. This is the misfortune that being in authority, even in jest, brings with it. To resume. That afternoon their host, Don Antonio Moreno, and his 2 friends, with Don Quixote and Sancho, went to the galleys. The commandant had been already made aware of his good fortune in seeing 2 such famous persons as Don Quixote and Sancho, and the instant they came to the shore all the galleys struck their awnings and the clarions rang out. A skiff, covered with rich carpets and cushions of crimson velvet, was immediately lowered into the water, and as soon as Don Quixote stepped on board of it, The leading galley fired her gangway gun, and the other galleys did the same. And as he mounted the starboard ladder, the whole crew saluted him, as is the custom when a personage of distinction comes on board a galley, by giving three cheers. The admiral, for so we shall call him, a Valencian gentleman of rank, gave him his hand and embraced him, saying,
"I shall mark this day with a white stone as one of the happiest I could expect to enjoy in my lifetime, since I have seen Señor Don Quixote of La Mancha, pattern and image wherein we see contained and condensed all that is worthy in knight-errantry."
Don Quixote, delighted beyond measure with such a lordly reception, replied to him in words no less courteous. All then proceeded to the poop, which was very handsomely decorated, and seated themselves on the bulwark benches. The boatswain passed along the gangway and piped all hands to strip, which they did in an instant. Sancho, seeing such a number of men stripped to the skin, was taken aback, and still more when he saw them spread the awning so briskly that it seemed to him as if all the devils were at work at it. But all this was cakes and fancy bread to what I am going to tell now. Sancho was seated on the captain's stage, close to the aftermost rower on the right-hand side. He, previously instructed in what he was to do, laid hold of Sancho, hoisting him up in his arms, and the whole crew who were standing ready, beginning on the right, proceeded to pass him on, whirling him along from hand to hand and from bench to bench, with such rapidity that it took the sight out of poor Sancho's eyes, and he made quite sure that the devils themselves were flying away with him. Nor did they leave off with him until they had sent him back along the left side and deposited him on the poop, and the poor fellow was left bruised and breathless and all in a sweat, and unable to comprehend what it was that had happened to him. Don Quixote, when he saw Sancho's flight without wings, asked the admiral if this was a usual ceremony with those who came on board the galleys for the first time, for if so, as he had no intention of adopting them as a profession, he had no mind to perform such feats of agility, and if anyone offered to lay hold of him to whirl him about, he vowed to God he would kick his soul out. And as he said this, he stood up and clapped his hand upon his sword. At this instant they struck the awning and lowered the yard with a prodigious rattle. Sancho thought heaven was coming off its hinges and going to fall on his head, and full of terror he ducked it and buried it between his knees. Nor were Don Quixote's knees altogether under control, for he too shook a little, squeezed his shoulders together, and lost colour. The crew then hoisted the yard with the same rapidity and clatter as when they lowered it, all the while keeping silence as though they had neither voice nor breath. The boatswain gave the signal to weigh anchor, and leaping upon the middle of the gangway, began to lay on to the shoulders of the crew with his courbash or whip, and to haul out gradually to sea. When Sancho saw so many red feet, for such he took the oars to be, moving all together, he said to himself, "It's these that are the real chanted things, and not the ones my master talks of. What can those wretches have done to be so whipped? And how does that one man who goes along there whistling dare to whip so many? I declare this is hell, or at least purgatory." Don Quixote, observing how attentively Sancho regarded what was going on, said to him,
"Ah, Sancho, my friend, how quickly and cheaply might you finish off the disenchantment of Dulcinea, if you would strip to the waist and take your place among those gentlemen. Amid the pain and sufferings of so many you would not feel your own much, and moreover, perhaps the sage Merlin would allow each of these lashes, being laid on with a good hand, to count for 10 of those which you must give yourself at last."
The admiral was about to ask what these lashes were, and what was Dulcinea's disenchantment, when a sailor exclaimed,
"Monjui signals that there is an oared vessel off the coast to the west."
On hearing this, the admiral sprang upon the gangway, crying,
"Now then, my sons, don't let her give us the slip. It must be some Algerine corsair brigantine that the watchtower signals to us."
The three others immediately came alongside the chief galley to receive their orders. The admiral ordered two to put out to sea while he with the other kept in shore, so that in this way the vessel could not escape them. The crews plied the oars, driving the galley so furiously that they seemed to fly. The two that had put out to sea, after a couple of miles, sighted a vessel which, so far as they could make out, they judged to be one of 14 or 15 rows of oars. And so she proved. As soon as the vessel discovered the galleys, she went about with the object and in the hope of making her escape by her speed, but the attempt failed, for the chief galley was one of the fastest vessels afloat, and overhauled her so rapidly that they on board the brigantine saw clearly there was no possibility of escaping, and the master of the brigantine, therefore, would have had them drop their oars and give themselves up so as not to provoke the captain in command of our galleys to anger. But chance, directing things otherwise, so ordered it that just as the chief galley came close enough for those on board the vessel to hear the shouts from her calling on them to surrender, two Turks, both drunken, that with a dozen more were on board the brigantine, discharged their muskets, killing two of the soldiers that lined the sides of our vessel. Seeing this, the admiral swore he would not leave one of those he found on board the vessel alive, but as he bore down furiously upon her, she slipped away from him underneath the oars. The galley shot a good way ahead. Those on board the vessel saw their case was desperate, and while the galley was coming about, they made sail, and by sailing and rowing once more tried to sheer off. But their activity did not do them as much good as their rashness did them harm. For the galley, coming up with them in a little more than half a mile, threw her oars over them and took the whole of them alive. The other two galleys now joined company, and all four returned with the prize to the beach, where a vast multitude stood waiting for them, eager to see what they brought back. The admiral anchored close in, and perceived that the viceroy of the city was on the shore. He ordered the skiff to push off to fetch him, and the yard to be lowered for the purpose of hanging forthwith the brigantine captain and the rest of the men taken on board the vessel, about 36 in number, all smart fellows and most of them Turkish musketeers. He asked which was the captain of the brigantine, and was answered in Spanish by one of the prisoners, who afterwards proved to be a Spanish renegade.
"This young man, senor, that you see here is our captain."
And he pointed to one of the handsomest and most gallant-looking youths that could be imagined. He did not seem to be 20 years of age.
"Tell me, dog," said the admiral, "what led you to kill my soldiers when you saw it was impossible for you to escape? Is that the way to behave to chief galleys? Know you not that rashness is not valour? Faint prospects of success should make men bold, but not rash."
The captain was about to reply, but the admiral could not at that moment listen to him, as he had to hasten to receive the viceroy, who was now coming on board the galley, and with him certain of his attendants and some of the people.
"You have had a good chase, Senor Admiral," said the viceroy.
"Your Excellency shall soon see how good by the game strung up to this yard," replied the admiral.
"How so?" replied the viceroy.
"Because," said the admiral, "against all law, reason, and usages of war, they have killed on my hands two of the best soldiers on board these galleys, and I have sworn to hang every man that I have taken, but above all this youth who is the captain of the brigantine."
And he pointed to him as he stood with his hands already bound and the rope round his neck, ready for death. The viceroy looked at him, and seeing him so well favoured, so graceful, and so submissive, he felt a desire to spare his life, the comeliness of the youth furnishing him at once with a letter of recommendation. He therefore questioned him, saying,
"Tell me, captain, art thou Turk, Moor, or renegade?"
To which the youth replied, also in Spanish,
"I am neither Turk, nor Moor, nor renegade."
"What art thou, then?" said the viceroy.
"A Christian woman," replied the youth.
"A woman? And a Christian in such a dress and in such circumstances? It is more marvellous than credible," said the viceroy.
"Suspend the execution of the sentence," said the youth. "Your vengeance will not lose much by waiting while I tell you the story of my life." What heart could be so hard as not to be softened by these words, at any rate so far as to listen to what the unhappy youth had to say? The admiral bade him say what he pleased, but not to expect pardon for his flagrant offence. With this permission, the youth began in these words. "Born of Moorish parents, I am of that nation, more unhappy than wise, upon which of late a sea of woes has poured down. In the course of our misfortune I was carried to Barbary by two uncles of mine, for it was in vain that I declared I was a Christian, as in fact I am, and not a mere pretended one, or outwardly, but a true Catholic Christian. It availed me nothing with those charged with our sad expatriation to protest this, nor would my uncles believe it. On the contrary, they treated it as an untruth and a subterfuge set up to enable me to remain behind in the land of my birth. And so, more by force than of my own will, they took me with them. I had a Christian mother, and a father who was a man of sound sense and a Christian too. I imbibed the Catholic faith with my mother's milk. I was well brought up, and neither in word nor in deed did I think, show any sign of being a Morisco. To accompany these virtues, for such I hold them, my beauty, if I possess any, grew with my growth. And great as was the seclusion in which I lived, It was not so great, but that a young gentleman, Don Gaspar Gregorio by name, eldest son of a gentleman who was lord of a village near ours, contrived to find opportunities of seeing me. How he saw me, how we met, how his heart was lost to me and mine not kept from him would take too long to tell, especially at a moment when I am in dread of the cruel cord that threatens me, interposing between tongue and throat. I will only say, therefore, that Don Gregorio chose to accompany me in our banishment. He joined company with the Moriscos who were going forth from other villages, for he knew their language very well, and on the voyage he struck up a friendship with my two uncles who were carrying me with them. For my father, like a wise and far-sighted man, as soon as he heard the first edict for our expulsion, quitted the village and departed in quest of some refuge for us abroad. He left, hidden and buried, at a spot of which I alone have knowledge, a large quantity of pearls and precious stones of great value, together with a sum of money in gold cruzados and doubloons. He charged me on no account to touch the treasure, if by any chance they expelled us before his return. I obeyed him, and with my uncles, as I have said, and others of our kindred and neighbours, passed over to Barbary, and the place where we took up our abode was Algiers, much the same as if we had taken it up in hell itself. The king heard of my beauty, and report told him of my wealth, which was in some degree fortunate for me. He summoned me before him and asked me what part of Spain I came from, and what money and jewels I had. I mentioned the place, and I told him the jewels and money were buried there, but that they might easily be recovered if I myself went back for them. All this I told him, in dread lest my beauty and not his own covetousness should influence him. While he was engaged in conversation with me, they brought him word that in company with me was one of the handsomest and most graceful youths that could be imagined. I knew at once that they were speaking of Don Gaspar Gregorio, whose comeliness surpasses the most highly vaunted beauty. I was troubled when I thought of the danger he was in, for among those barbarous Turks a fair youth is more esteemed than a woman, be she ever so beautiful. The king immediately ordered him to be brought before him that he might see him, and asked me if what they said about the youth was true. I then, almost as if inspired by heaven, told him it was, but that I would have him to know it was not a man, but a woman like myself, and I entreated him to allow me to go and dress her in the attire proper to her, so that her beauty might be seen to perfection, and that she might present herself before him with less embarrassment. He bade me go by all means, and said that the next day we should discuss the plan to be adopted for my return to Spain to carry away the hidden treasure. I saw Don Gaspar. I told him the danger he was in if he let it be seen he was a man. I dressed him as a Moorish woman, and that same afternoon I brought him before the king, who was charmed when he saw him, and resolved to keep the damsel and make a present of her to the Grand Signor. And to avoid the risk she might run among the women of his seraglio, and distrustful of himself, he commanded her to be placed in the house of some Moorish ladies of rank, who would protect and attend to her. And thither he was taken at once. What we both suffered, for I cannot deny that I love him, may be left to the imagination of those who are separated if they love one another dearly. The king then arranged that I should return to Spain in this brigantine, and that two Turks, those who killed your soldiers, should accompany me. There also came with me this Spanish renegade, and here she pointed to him who had first spoken, whom I know to be secretly a Christian, and to be more desirous of being left in Spain than of returning to Barbary. The rest of the crew of the brigantine are Moors and Turks, who merely serve as rowers. The two Turks, greedy and insolent, instead of obeying the orders we had to land me in this renegade in Christian dress, with which we came provided, on the first Spanish ground we came to, chose to run along the coast and make some prize if they could, fearing that if they put us ashore first, we might, in case of some accident befalling us, make it known that the brigantine was at sea, and thus, if there happened to be any galleys on the coast, they might be taken. We sighted this shore last night, and knowing nothing of these galleys, we were discovered, and the result was what you have seen. To sum up, there is Don Gregorio in woman's dress, among women, in imminent danger of his life, and here am I, with hands bound in expectation, or rather in dread, of losing my life, of which I am already weary. Here, sirs, ends my sad story as true as it is unhappy. All I ask of you is to allow me to die like a Christian, for as I have already said, I am not to be charged with the offence of which those of my nation are guilty."
And she stood silent, her eyes filled with moving tears, accompanied by plenty from the bystanders. The viceroy, touched with compassion, went up to her without speaking and untied the cord that bound the hands of the Moorish girl. But all the while the Morisco Christian was telling her strange story, an elderly pilgrim who had come on board of the galley at the same time as the viceroy kept his eyes fixed upon her. And the instant she ceased speaking, he threw himself at her feet, and embracing them, said in a voice broken by sobs and sighs,
"Oh, Anna Felix, my unhappy daughter, I am thy father Ricote, come back to look for thee. Unable to live without thee, my soul that thou art!"
At these words of his, Sancho opened his eyes and raised his head, which he had been holding down, brooding over his unlucky excursion. And looking at the pilgrim, he recognized in him that same Ricote he met the day he quitted his government, and felt satisfied that this was his daughter. She, being now unbound, embraced her father, mingling her tears with his, while he, addressing the admiral and viceroy, said,
"This, sirs, is my daughter, more unhappy in her adventures than in her name. She is Anna Felix, surnamed Ricote, celebrated as much for her own beauty as for my wealth. I quitted my native land in search of some shelter or refuge for us abroad, and having found one in Germany, I returned in this pilgrim's dress, in the company of some other German pilgrims, to seek my daughter and take up a large quantity of treasure I had left buried. My daughter I did not find. The treasure I found and have with me. And now, in this strange roundabout way you have seen, I find the treasure that more than all makes me rich, my beloved daughter. If our innocence and her tears and mine can with strict justice open the door to clemency, extend it to us. For we never had any intention of injuring you, nor do we sympathize with the aims of our people, who have been justly banished."
"I know Ricote well," said Sancho at this, "and I know, too, that what he says about Anna Felix being his daughter is true. But as to those other particulars about coming and going and having good or bad intentions, I say nothing."
While all present stood amazed at this strange occurrence, the admiral said,
"At any rate, your tears will not allow me to keep my oath. Live, fair Anna Felix, all the years that heaven has allotted you. But these rash, insolent fellows must pay the penalty of the crime they have committed."
And with that he gave orders to have the two Turks who had killed his two soldiers hanged at once at the yardarm. The viceroy, however, begged him earnestly not to hang them, as their behaviour savoured rather of madness than of bravado. The admiral yielded to the viceroy's request, for revenge is not easily taken in cold blood. They then tried to devise some scheme for rescuing Don Gaspar Gregorio from the danger in which he had been left. Ricote offered for that object more than 2,000 ducats that he had in pearls and gems. They proposed several plans, but none so good as that suggested by the renegade already mentioned, who offered to return to Algiers in a small vessel of about 6 rows of oars, manned by Christian rowers, as he knew where, how, and when he could and should land, nor was he ignorant of the house in which Don Gaspar was staying. The admiral and the viceroy had some hesitation about placing confidence in the renegade and entrusting him with the Christians who were to row, but Anna Felix said she could answer for him, and her father offered to go and pay the ransom of the Christians if, by any chance, they should not be forthcoming. This, then, being agreed upon, the viceroy landed, and Don Antonio Moreno took the fair Morisco and her father home with him, the viceroy charging him to give them the best reception and welcome in his power, while on his own part he offered all that house contained for their entertainment. So great was the goodwill and kindliness the beauty of Anna Felix had infused into his heart. Chapter 64. Treating of the adventure which gave Don Quixote more unhappiness than all that had hitherto befallen him. The wife of Don Antonio Moreno, so the history says, was extremely happy to see Anna Felix in her house. She welcomed her with great kindness, charmed as well by her beauty as by her intelligence, for in both respects the fair Morisco was richly endowed, and all the people of the city flocked to see her, as though they had been summoned by the ringing of the bells. Don Quixote told Don Antonio that the plan adopted for releasing Don Gregorio was not a good one, for its risks were greater than its advantages, and that it would be better to land himself with his arms and horse